Okay, we are starting Perek Chet today. Perek Chet was where we were up to before. We had we had one class that we kind of shifted from Daniel to Pesach before Pesach itself. So we're going to make up that class, and it's sort of a transition between the previous unit, which was about Daniel and his experience in the Babylonian environment, his both the stories related to his encounter with Nebuchadnezzar and with Belshazzar and the writing on the wall prophecy, as well as the one prophecy we read in chapter 7, which began at the beginning. I'm going to go back for 1 second, which began in the beginning of Perek Zayin, was Bishnat Achat LeBelshazzar Melech Bavel, the first year of Belshazzar, who is the third of the Babylonian kings, the third and the last in Tanakh. And Daniel had a vision. And we talked about that vision with the various animals, the four animals that arrived, that came out of the sea and what they represented and various possible interpretations. I'm not going to rehash that for now. It is recorded and available online. But this is the next chapter, and it starts Bishnat Shalosh, L'malchut Belshazzar HaMelech. We're still in the time frame of Belshazzar. So even though I had indicated that our focus now is going to shift to the next era, which is Persia, we will, B'ezrat Hashem, in our next next chapter, do so. But we'll already see that this kind of brings us into the domain of a discussion around Persia and how that Daniel's relationship with Persia as well. So I'm going to jump right in. Stop me if you have any questions or if you are if something goes wrong with the tech. Again, if you are just joining us, here is the link to the sources. And there is also the text of the book itself. So there's two separate source pages we're going to be using. This is the text. Mishnat Shalosh L'Malchut Belshazzar. Now, one of the things, if you've been following along up until now, one of the things you'll notice right away is there's only two columns here, unlike the previous chapters, which had three columns. That's because Perek Chet is that moment in the book where the text itself shifts back from Aramaic to Hebrew. So we're now back into the original language of the text of the book, which is here till the end of the Sefer in Hebrew. I do not have a good explanation as to why some parts in Aramaic and some parts are in Hebrew. I'm not going to venture into a guess because I just don't know. So that's as truthful and honest an answer I can give you. Bishnat Shalosh L'Malchut Belshazzar HaMelech, third year of Belshazzar, which is the same year that Daniel was invited to Belshazzar's palace because Belshazzar saw that writing on the wall. That whole prophecy, that whole experience, writing on the wall and Daniel's explanation of it, mini tekel ufarsin, that was all the same year. Third year Belshazzar, it's the final year of Belshazzar in Tanakh, and Daniel has a vision. Nireh Elai Ani Daniel, Achareh Nireh Elai Batchila. This is the continuation of a vision after what I saw initially. In other words, chapter 7, chapter 8. Chapter 7 was the beginning of Belshazzar, the four animals representing, as we interpreted it, the three kings of Babel and the king of Persia, or as the Mepharshim explaineth, four kingdoms. That whole experience, this is the continuation of that vision. Ve'ereh b'chazon, ve'hi b'ra'oti v'ani b'shushan habira asher be'elam hamedina. I was in Shushan, the capital, which is in the province of Elam. So Daniel is there out in Shushan. If you remember, everything else is happening in Babel. Daniel is out in Shushan. There is he's disconnected from the Babylonian kings from Belshazzar. He has to be called back to Belshazzar's palace. Ve'ereh b'chazon, ve'ani hayiti al uval ulai. And in this vision, he was standing at the stream, the river Ulai, and he sees the following. Ve'sayinai ve'ereh, v'hine ayil echad omed lifnei ha'uval v'lo kranayim. There was a ram by the stream, and this ram had two horns, kranayim, not karnayim, which be a plural, but kranayim, meaning two. Ve'akranayim gvohot, they were tall horns. Ve'achat gvoha min hashenit, one was higher than the other. Ve'hagvoha ola ba'achrona, the higher one came up last. Why that's relevant? as we see the interpretation, we'll see it's a little detail, but it happens to be accurate. Re'iti et ha'ayl, minageach yama v'tzafona v'negba, I saw this ram goring, pushing north, west, north, south. Chol chayot lo ya'amodna lefanav. And all of the beasts could not stand before it. Ve'en matzil miyado. And no one could deliver anyone from the hands of this beast. Yasak kirtzono v'igdil. It did as it will, as it wanted. Made itself exceedingly great, magnified. This ram was on a rampage and no one could stop it. V'ani ha'iti mevin. V'nei tzfir ha'izim ba min ha'ma'arav. And as I was considering, mevin, understanding, trying to understand and watch, behold, tzfir ha'izim, a he-goat, ba min ha'ma'arav, came from the west. Apnei kol ha'aretz. It was covering the earth. Ve'en nogeh ba'aretz. It seemed to be going so fast and so quick that it didn't even touch the ground. It was hovering above the ground as if it was flying. Ve'atzafir keren chazut ben inav. And this tzafir, this goat, had one conspicuous horn between its eyes. Unlike the ram, which had two horns, this goat had a single horn. Ve'yavo ad ha'ayl bal ha'kranayim. This goat came to this ram. Asherit yomed lifnei uval v'yarot zila b'chamat kocho and ran into it with all its fury. Ur'itiv magia etzal ha'ayl. I saw it come to the ram v'yit marmar elav and it was bitter. It was sick. V'yachat ha'ayl. It smote the ram. V'yishaber et shtei kranav and it smashed its two horns. The isle did not have the strength to stand before this goat that was flying through the air. It threw him to the ground. It trampled over him. No one could deliver the ram from the hands of this goat. And this goat was great, exceedingly, in its strength, nishpira ha-keren ha-gdola, at its height, at its heyday, at its moment of strength, this great horn broke, and in its place, v'ta'alena chazut arba tachteha, came up four other horns, l'arba ruchot ha-shamayim, to the four corners of the earth. And out of these came one little horn, meaning the smallest of these four, or maybe an additional one, it's unclear. And it grew towards the south, the east, and the beautiful land, meaning referring to the land of Israel. It waxed great even up against the hosts of heaven. Vatapel arza min hatzavau min hakochavim, and it continued to challenge. Vatapel arza, it threw to the ground from the armies, from the hosts of the heavens and the stars, and trampled upon them. Viad sar hatzava higdil, it magnified itself even against the prince of the host. Mimenu hurama tamid, and then the burnt offering was taken away. Ushlach mochon mikdasho, and the place of his sanctuary, his mikdash, was cast down. Vitzavati natena latamid befesha, the host, the army, was given over to it with the burnt offering, through transgression, meaning the burnt offering was removed because of its transgression together with the army. Vatashlech emet arza, truth was cast to the ground. And it prospered and it trampled and it destroyed. Veshma echad kadosh midaber, And then I heard one of the holy ones referring to the Malachim. Daniel refers to the angels as Kadosh, Kadoshim, speaking. And one said to another, Ad matay chazon atamid ve'apesh shomem. How long will it be, this vision of the burnt offering being trampled upon? Tet v'kodesh tzva mirmas, and the burnt offering, the transgression, the sanctuary to be trampled underfoot. How long is this going to go on? Ve'omer elai ad erev boker alpaim shloshma. He said, until evening, morning, 2,300. And then v'nitzdak kodesh, then the sanctuary shall be victorious. That's the vision. And the vision itself stops here, and we could we could try to guess what it is referring to. But we don't really need to do too much guessing, because Daniel himself inquired, "Vayibiroti ani Daniel et chazon." When I, Daniel, saw this vision, "Va'avaksha bina," I sought to understand it. And standing near me was an appearance of a man, we'll see in a moment, referring to a malach. Veshma kol adam ben Ulai. I heard the voice of a man by the banks of Ulai. Vayikra v'yomar, I called out and said, Gavriel, which of course is a reference to the malach Gavriel. There are a number of malachim we have identified by name in Jewish tradition. One is Gavriel, and Gavriel is the only place in Tanakh where Gavriel is mentioned by name, is here in Sefer Daniel. Every other reference is in rabbinic literature. We'll see another malach later on also mentioned by name, but those are the only two. Vayomar Gavriel, haven lahalaz et mareh. Can you explain to me this vision? Vayavo et salomdi. So he came near to me where I was standing. Ubifo'o. Nivati, when he came, I trembled. I fell on my face. And he said to me, Haven ben Adam, understand this, son of man. This is a vision belonging to the end of time. When he spoke to me, I fell on my face. He touched me, he stood me up, gave me strength. He said to me, I am sharing with you what will be at the end of time of indignation, or the latter time of indignation. This is for the appointed time. So now we're going to figure it all out. He's going to tell us exactly what this vision represents. Ha'ayil asheraita balaklanayim, the two-horned ram. Who do you think the two-horned ram is? That's easy. Malchei Madayu Paras. Mede Persia united. Why two horns? Because, right, they're two kingdoms. Persia is an alliance of two major peoples or nations. It's why it's sort of become the strong Persian Empire by the united front of Madai and Paras, Mede and Persia. Mede comes first historically, but Persia is much stronger, and hence the smaller horn first and then the larger horn behind it. We mentioned that earlier. And that Safira is Sa'ir, as for the Hikot, Melech Yavan. That's the king of Greece. So who is the king of Greece with one horn that beats Persia, that defeats Persia? That one should be easy. Anybody want to venture a guess? Who is the king of Persia who defeats Persia? The king of Greece with a single horn that defeats Persia?
Alexander.
Alexander the Great, correct. The Akeren Agdolah Sheben Einav Hu HaMelech HaRishon. That horn between its eyes, that is the first king. And then the story continues. It broke, Vanishberet, referring to, we can already begin to guess where this is all going, referring to What happened to what does a horn breaking represent? Horn breaking usually represents
the end of the
kingdom.
End of the kingdom or the death of the king. In this case, the death of the king, the death of Alexander the Great in the year 323 BCE. We'll come to the history of it in a second. Vatamodna arba tachteha. And in its place arose four. We'll see what those four refer to. Arba malchuyot migoy ya'amodna velo b'kocho. Four kingdoms shall arise out of that one kingdom, but not with his power, much smaller and much less powerful. Uba'achrit malchutam, at the end of their kingdom, yotem ha'pushim, when their transgressors have completed their transgression, Yamod Melech az panim umevin chidot. Shall arise a king of fierce countenance, an understanding strategy. This was that the last little horn that came and waged war with the heavens. Yatzam kocho velo b'kocho, his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. B'niflaot yashchit. He shall destroy terribly, v'itzliach, v'yasah, and shall do and be prosperous, and shall succeed, v'shchit atzumim, and he shall destroy mightily. The Am Kedoshim, he will destroy the people of the Holy Ones, meaning Am Yisrael, which is his reference to the Jewish people throughout the book. V'al sichlo, and as for his cunning, v'itzliach mirma b'yado, and his cunning shall be, he shall cause craft to prosper, and in his heart he shall make himself great, and in his security he shall destroy many. He shall even stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And that's the conclusion of the story part of the vision, except we then have this conversation about the 2300 umareha erev boker asher nemar, that which was said about the vision evening and mornings, 2300 emetu, it is true. However, v'yata stom hechazon, seal it up, hide it, ki liyamim rabim, for it belongs to many years to come. I, Daniel, was faint and sick for days from this vision. I came, I rose, I did with the king's business. And I was quiet about this vision and did not understand it. And that's the end of Parakat. All right. So, there are parts of this story that are very clear, and there are parts that are less so. So the parts that are very clear is that ultimately the main centerpiece of this vision is a story of two empires, namely right, the Isle and the Seir. You have the ram and the goat, the ram representing the two horns of Mede and Persia, Madayu Paras, and the goat, the single horn representing the conquest of Persia by Alexander the Great. That part's easy. And the Mefarshim identified this almost unanimously across the board. The Sar, let's go down here. The breaking of the horn. Let's see what we can see. Let's look at it first, right? And then the most important part of it is that after this ram that will cut, this goat that will come and destroy the ram, Keren Gula Sheben Enav Nishberet. That horn is broken, referring to the death of Alexander the Great. And in the aftermath of the death of Alexander the Great, what will emerge eventually are four kingdoms from it, but not with his strength. So this already is probably the most direct historical reference in this parak to what is he referring to. Who are these four kingdoms that will emerge from the death of Alexander the Great, but not with his strength and character? So if you look at the Mefarshim, almost unanimously, they all talk about the death of this of Alexander the Great will lead to Nechleka Malchuto L'Arba'a Melachim. Nebuchadnezzar writes, his kingdom will be divided up into four kingdoms, into four sub-kingdoms. Rashi similarly, Al Yedei Gdudav, no, sorry, that's the wrong Rashi, this one. ותעמודנה ארבע תחתיה, כמו שכתוב בספר החלום למעלה, דלת מלכויות אשר יעמודנה מאותו גוי, four kingdoms which will emerge or rise from that nation, שחילק אלכסנדרוס מוקדון מלכותו במותו לארבעה ילדים. For he divided his kingdom upon his death unto four youths, he calls them, assuming they're his children, which they are in fact not. However, he quotes the fact that he is aware that Yosef, referring to the Yosifun or Josephus, Ka'am b'sifo arba rashenimai, they were the heads of a leopard. And they were not his sons of the king. B'lo b'nei melachayu. So before we get to the latter part of this kingdom, of this vision, and this part of it's easy. Right? To what is Daniel referring to when he talks about the breakdown of the death of Alexander, followed by the breakdown of the kingdom into four separate kingdoms? If you know anything about the story of Alexander the Great in the aftermath, this is a direct reference to what has been known, what is called the War of the Successors, or the War of the Diadochi, I think it's pronounced, depending on the English pronunciation or the American pronunciation. The wars of the Diadochi or Diadochi are the wars of the successors of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, this is taken straight off just a simple website called worldhistory.org. There are many places you can go to get the history of it. It's a fascinating story, but it has relevance to us only in its conclusion. After the Alexander's conquests, the story of Alexander the Great is really an extraordinary piece of history because Alexander conquers all of the existing empires of the time and really unites the world under his banner in a way that hadn't been done, creates the largest empire. All of this is all part of the kingdom of Alexander the Great up until the point of his death. He dies in the year 323 BCE, 10th and 11th of June. There's some discussions to how he died, whether he was poisoned or whether he got sick. Unclear, but the apocryphal story goes, when asked who would succeed him, Alexander made a comment about the strongest will succeed him. Obviously not his sons. He doesn't have enough children to succeed him, which answer led to his empire eventually being divided between four of his generals. They were not his children. They were his generals, Cassander, Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Seleucus, known as the Diadochi, or the successors. What ensued was a 15 to 20 year series of wars across the entire kingdom. Without getting into all of the details of who was involved in the various, there are lots of different players and there's lots of intrigue and the fighting against each other. By the time it all settles down, the longtime comrade Cassander would order the execution of Alexander's wife, Roxana, and Alexander's son by her, and Alexander's mother, Olympias, to consolidate his power, and he would become the new king of Macedonia, title he would later lose to Antigonus I. Ptolemy is said to have stolen Alexander's corpse as it was en route to Macedon and spirited away to Egypt in the hope of securing the prophecy that the land in which he laid to rest would be prosperous and unconquerable, and he would found the Ptolemaic dynasty in Egypt. Seleucus founded the Seleucid Empire in more or less what is today Persia and Iraq. Seleucus, comprising Mesopotamia, Anatolia, parts of India, would be the last remaining of the Diadochi after the incessant 40 years of war between them. He became known as Seleucus I. And then, of course, there is the fourth, which is Antigonus or Cassander in, Seleucus, Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Cassander, are the four Diadochi of his successors. Why is that of any relevance to a story in Tanakh? Good question. I'm glad you asked. Because, I don't know why it's relevant to any part of Tanakh. It's relevant because it's mentioned here. But we shall see that from a Jewish perspective, the only part of this story that is relevant to Tanakh is, of the four kingdoms that emerge, which one of these is the most important for us to identify historically, relevant to the story of the Jewish people.
The Seleucids.
Seleucus dynasty, Seleucus dynasty, correct? Because eventually that will come to Antiochus. This area here, this patch of brown between the Seleucus dynasty and the Ptolemy dynasty, between Egypt and Mesopotamia, becomes the battleground, the tug of war between Seleucus and Ptolemy dynasties later in history. And of course, that becomes the story of Antiochus and the story of Hanukkah. And so for us, this is the ground zero for the tug of war between these two major empires hundreds of years later, right? This is not, this is already into the story of Hanukkah, which is a hundred and some odd years later. Okay. So up to that point, that's fairly straightforward. Where things get a little bit tricky now, and for us, the most important relevance of this prophecy is what comes next. Because after the division of these four kingdoms, ub'acharit malchutam, after that has taken place in a future time, yatem ha'poshim ya'amod melech azpanim, then a king shall arise who is fierce in countenance and understanding of strategy, mevi chidot, yatzam kocho, with great strength, and he will set his sights against the heavens. And he will, even up into V'asar Samim Yamod, he will even go against the head, the Am Kedoshim, the peoples, and the Sar, and the heavens, and the Tamid, and the Korban Tamid, and the Mikdash. All of this will fall into his hands. And the big question, of course, is, to whom is this last part of the story referring? Ishchit atzumim va'am kedoshim, who will destroy even the people of saints, the holy people, people of Israel. To whom is this melech azpanim? And what relevance is the prophecy of the time frame of Paim Shloshmiot? And no surprise to us, this is exactly brings us back to the same debate we had back in chapter 7. In fact, the calculations used to explain the 2300 years here are exactly the same. And so Rashi classically suggests Yitzhak Keren Achat, this last kingdom that will emerge eventually to wage war against heaven and against the temple, that is a reference to Malchut Titus Yotzet Mimenu, the kingdom of Titus that will emerge from it, meaning Rome. And so we have Persia, we have the war of the Diadochi after Alexander, the Attikai after Alexander the Great, and then eventually Rome. So says Rashi. As for the 2000, as for the war against the Korban Tamid, says Rashi, that's because at the end of the Second Temple period, one of the things that they did was to eliminate the daily sacrifice from the operation of the temple. And for that, he sent Nero Caesar. And so the reference here again to the end of Bait Shein, to the Korban of the Second Temple. And Rashi explicitly identifies this king in the last comment, Bachrit Malchutam, Kishegi Zaman Shitamu Rishay Yisrael, when the time will come when the wicked of Israel shall be punished, Yamod Melech Azpanim, this brazen king will arise, who? Titus. And so Rashi, like so many other Mefarshim, pretty much almost, I would say, unanimously across the board amongst the classic medieval commentaries, assumes that this vision is about three parts. Persia, which falls to Greece, and Greece eventually falls to Rome as part of the punishment of Israel for their sins, and that will be the condition of the Jewish people until Alpayim Shloshmiot, until this number of 2,300, whatever this number represents. Similarly, Ibn Ezra comments that the four kingdoms will divide up the land of the region of Alexander the Great. We'll get into all those details. He makes one change. He says this Melech Azpanim, which we'll come back to not today, but next week, he identifies as Antiochus. We'll talk about that next, Bezrat Hashem next week. He also quotes a tradition from the Gaonim that this Melech Azpanim, who HaKedari or Kidri, referring to, I believe, Muhammad, who arises, was born in the year 594 or 4354, according to the Ibn Ezra. Interesting reference there as well. But For the most part, the Mefarshim are all of the opinion, with the exception of the Ibn Ezra we'll talk about next week, that this Melech Azpanim has something to do with the destruction of the temple, and the Alpayim Shloshmiot vision, which Daniel is told is emet, is true, but is also a mystery. Emet, right? Umareh ha'erev ha'abokar shen emar emetu v'yatah stom ha'chazon, but you now have to hide it so it's not clearly identifiable. So our job, of course, is to decipher that which Daniel encodes. That's our job. Our job is to take a look at Tanakh, Daniel encodes it, and our job is to decipher it. That's how the Mefarshim operate. So this is going to lead us to exactly where we were in the previous chapter, with a bunch of different calculations on what these 2,300 years refer to. When do they start, and when do they end? And we're going to be in almost the exact same conversation we were back before Pesach. It's going to sound like a little bit of deja vu. So we're going to start, and we remember when we went through this the first time in chapter 7, we went through Sajagun, we went through Rashi, we went through Abarbanel, we went through the Malbim, and we went through the sequence amongst all of the classic Mefarshim. We're going to do the same thing. With Sajagun's comment, your interpretation is brought down in a few places. It's brought down in Rashi. It's brought down in the Ibn Ezra. This is the simplest place where I found it, which is in the Ibn Ezra. Hagaon Rav Sadia Amar ki alpayim shlosh miot hem shanim. The first thing we need to understand is that these 2,300 are years. And then we need to know where they start from. Utchilatam migalut Mitzrayim. And they start with the Exodus from Egypt. Sorry, that's my translation, and it's incorrect. They start with the exile to Egypt. Megalut Mitzrayim. So that word is incorrect. I tried to translate this freestyle, and I made a mistake. Umatam lachem misham se Ibn Ezra says, I don't understand. Why would you start from there? Why would you start from the exile to Egypt? Od echu shenat erev aboker. What does erev aboker mean in that context? And the time frame that this calculation comes to, Kfar Moed, is already passed. But years ago, Shanim Rabot. So Ibn Ezra says this can't be right. But that is, in fact, Absadjagon's interpretation, that the 2,300 is exactly 2,300 from Galut Mitzrayim, from the exile to Egypt, which takes us from the year 2448 plus 2,300 to the year 4748 in the Hebrew calendar, with the year 988 in the CE in the secular calendar, which is exactly, if you remember, I didn't pull it up, but if you remember the source pages we had from the chapter 7, that was the same calculation, right? It's exactly the same calculation. These are this is your chronology chart of Tanakh. Avram is born in the year 1948 from creation, Birth of Yitzchak the year 2048, 100 years later, Exodus, the Exodus is 400 years later, is 2448. Sorry, I was correct the first time. This is calculated from Yetziat Mitzrayim, not from Galut Mitzrayim. Okay. The first temple is 480 years later. In the year 2928, the first temple is destroyed 410 years later in 3338. The second temple begins in 3408, 70 years later. The second temple is destroyed, according to Seder Olam, 420 years later in the year 3828, or the year 68 of the Common Era. So those are the numbers that the Rishonim use. Despite how they interpret Tanakh, the Rishonim all use the same numbers. Okay. Without getting into the accuracy of the numbers historically, not our issue for now. We're dealing with text interpretation. These are the numbers that the Rishonim use. So Sajagon says 2448 is Yitzhak Mitzrayim. Add 2300 years to that, because that's Erev Boker Alpayim Shloshma 2300. You get 4748, or the year 988 in the Common Era. And says of Sajagon, that's when the time frame is up for the duration of this Roman conquest, destruction of the temple. Of course, Ebenezer says, it doesn't make any sense because Ebenezer lived many years later and that year has come and gone and nothing has happened. So that interpretation cannot be correct. And as we saw when we went through this calculation in chapter 7, every time the Rishonim go, they offer a date and the date passes, the attitude is, the calculation must be wrong. Rashi says this explicitly. Rashi also is dealing with, and remember, this calculation has to dovetail with the calculation they used back in chapter 7, which was about the time and the time and a half. Remember that whole story? Time, time and a half, two times, three times, all those numbers. So Rashi quotes the same issue and he comes to the same problem. He says, Ad Erev Boker Paim Shloshmiot, says Rashi, Erev and Boker, in order to them to make any sense, have to be a gematria. They have to be encoded numerically. Why does Rashi assume that? He says, for two reasons. Number one, because this cheshbon has to match the calculations that appear at the end of the book of Daniel. Daniel, at the end of the book, has two additional numbers. Remember what they were? One was 1290, and the other is 1335. At the very end of, I'll just show you the two texts. The very end of Perek Yud Bet, there the pasuk says, "Umeetu sar hatamid," the time that the burnt offering ceases, "Velatet shikutz mishomem," and the detestable thing is put upon the altar. From that point, the end of the burnt offering, meaning 6 years, Rashi says, before the destruction of the temple, "Yamim elef umatayim tishim," will be 1,290 years. Rashi translates this as years. Elef Matayim Tishim. 1,290 years. Happy is the one who waits for the years 1,335. Elef Shloshmiot Shloshim Chamesh. So in addition to the 2,300, I need to figure out these other two numbers, 1290 and 1335. So putting all these numbers together, the only way this makes sense, as Rashi, is to assume that this Erev Boker is in fact a further code of a gematria. And secondly, Gavriel himself says to Daniel that this is a vision that is true, but also hidden. It's a code. So what's the most common code in Tanakh? Gematria. Okay. So therefore, Erev Boker and gematria, what, anybody want to do a quick calculation? How much is Erev Boker and gematria? No.
574.
There it is. The gematria, 574. Correct. Excellent. Very good. You did the math, which is good. Add that to the 2300 and you get 2874. Okay. Remember that number. Then we have Nitzdak Kodesh. After that, the Holy One shall be exonerated. The iniquity of Israel shall be expiated to bring about an end to the decrees of their being trodden upon and crumbled, since they were in exile in the first exile to Egypt, until they will be redeemed and saved with the perpetual salvation by a King Mashiach, and his computation terminates at the end of 1290 years from the daily sacrifice being removed, which is what it says at the end of the book. So, let's work through the numbers. Menachzor al Rishonot, says Rashi. How do these numbers work? Well, it's very simple. Here you have it. 210 years they're in Egypt. 480 years, it says, from the time they left Egypt until the temple is built. First temple stood for 410 years. Second temple stood for 420 years. 70-year exile in between them. Then add 1290 to the end of days, except you have to subtract 6 years because the daily offering was removed 6 years before the destruction. And add the 2300 and the 574, and you have it all together. Okay, so let's simplify this to very simple. We're going to start from Golut Mitzrayim, from going down to Egypt. There are 210 years in Egypt. 480 years till they leave Egypt till they build the first temple. 410 years till they build the standing of the first temple. 70 years in exile. 420 years the life of the second temple. Then I add the reference to the end of the book of Daniel, 1290 years from the time that the Korban Tamid ceases, 6 years before the destruction of the temple. I get to 512. Add 45 years, that last verse, Ashrei HaMechakeh, happy is the one who waits. I get to 5157. 5157 corresponds to the English year 1397. Rashi says you get to the same place by this magical number 2300 plus Erev Boker. Because if you start at 2238, which is Galut Mitzrayim, and you add the 2300 for Erev Boker, right? That's the number here. Plus the coded Erev Boker, the Gematria 574. You're going to end up in the same place, 512, 238, plus 2300, 2300 plus 574 is going to end up in exactly the same place in the year 5112. You can see it's the same number. These two numbers together, 2300 plus 574, is exactly the same as all these numbers here together. 210 plus 480 plus 410 plus 70 plus 420 plus 1290 minus 6 is 2874. 2300 plus 574, these numbers here, exactly the same number. Rashi just calculates it from two different directions. He says the number here, 2300 plus Erev Boker Gematria, is exactly the same number as calculating the number of years from Galut Mitzrayim until the time of the temple is, the time of the Korban Tamid is removed in the 1290 that I mentioned at the end of the book. Does everybody understand this calculation? Right, this is very strange. This is a repeat of what we saw in the previous chapter. It's just Rashi brings it up here again because the Alpayim Shloshmot is the critical number here, but you have to add 574 and you end up in exactly the same calculation as we have been working all along. According to Rashi, Mashiach will come by the year 1397 of the English calendar. Of course, the problem for us is that the year 1397 has come and gone. And so we're left in the same quandary position that we were in when we looked at chapter 7. Is everybody with me? I hope I haven't gone too fast or confused everybody. This is all build up to where our conclusion is going to go. So if you're following it, great. If you're not, it's okay. We're going to get to a conclusion in a second. So that brings us to the Abarbanel. Quotes two other commentaries, one of the Rabag and one of the Ramban, who is bothered by the fact that these calculations have all come and gone. Sadia's calculation has come and gone. Rashi's calculation has come and gone. Something's amiss. And the answer usually lies in a later starting point for the 2300 missing years, right? So if 2300 is a magical number, then we need to work through. So Abarbanel suggests, he quotes two other opinions. The Rabag, who says that the Trilata Mispar, this I don't have a translation for, so I'm just going to translate as I read it. The Trilata Mispar, the beginning of the number, is Mimei Shmuel. If you start from the days of Shmuel and you add 2300, you're going to get to sometime in the middle of the 15th century. That was the beginning of the reign of Israel. The Ramban says that he made the beginning of the calculations, the beginning of David's kingdom, because that is the beginning of the reign of Malchut Beit David, which Mashiach is a descendant of. Says the Abarbanel, it's a very powerful line, Ve'ein tzarich lahakshot alehem. There's no need to challenge them, because history has proven them false. The calculated number that each one offered has passed. And we're still in exile. So clearly, that can't be right. So therefore, the Abarbanel says, the beginning of this number, this 2300, and by the way, with the exception of Rashi, they all assume 2300 is 2300, not 2300 plus Gematria Boker 574, etc. Just 2300. The beginning of this 2300 mysterious number is from Chiluk HaMalchuyot Asher Achar Yemot Shlomo. It starts from the day the kingdom splits apart. The logic of the Abarbanel's ration explanation is extraordinary. It says, if you want to sweep through history from the moment where the beginning of the end, the beginning of the end starts when the kingdom splits into two. When the kingdom splits after Shlomo HaMelech into northern and southern kingdoms, that spells the beginning of the end. It'll take several hundred years to reach it, but that's the beginning of the end. We can only be as strong as we are a single kingdom. Enough said. Ki az met shalom v'ashlemut min benehem. Once their kingdom was split, death, the peace and whole and completeness died with it. Ve'et shenechlekum me'achdutam. The az haya erev Yisrael. That was the beginning of the erev, the long night. Gam chashecha, darkness. Ki asher chalak lehem libam nashamu. When they were divided up, they were destroyed. The Gamba Bayit Sheni, even the Second Temple period, didn't have any greater light associated with it. Lo ra'u or amiti. I mean, they had birbuv tovot v'ra'ot l'boker. It was always mixed with conflict and tension, etc. So it was also a extension of the night of exile. Kacha heshiva pidarko ad erev boker apayim shlosh mlod v'tzono lamar. This will be the condition of us 2,300 years of nighttime of darkness until the morning dawn of redemption shall come. Until the time that we were divided, until we will be reunited under one kingdom united, 2,300 years later. And then Yitzhak Kodesh. Then we will be united. Then we'll be victorious. Okay. So how do you get to the year of the split of the kingdom? So that's not hard to figure out. Because, again, working with our same numbers, Yitziat Mitzrayim was in the year 2448. Yes, that's back to, that's our starting point. 2448, go back to here, 2448, Yitziat Mitzrayim. Everything starts there. Yitziat Mitzrayim is in the year 2448. Then we have another reference point, which is the temple is built. This is a pasuk in Sefer Melachim Aleph, Perek Vav. The temple is built 480 years after Yitziat Mitzrayim. So if the temple is built 480 years after Yitziat Mitzrayim, that's the fourth year of Shlomo HaMelech. And he reigns for 40 years. So if I add how many years after the temple is built is Shlomo on the throne? 36. 40 minus the 4 before the temple was built. And so he says, take the 2448, add to it the 480 years of first temple, until the first temple was built, add to it the 36 years of Shlomo's reign after he built the temple, and the year the temple was, the year the kingdom was divided comes to the year 2964. Add to that the Erev Boker Apayim Shloshma 2300. And then he says you have to have one year for overlapping because a lot of this overlaps, right? The temple is built in the fourth year and then there's 40 years in total. So you always have to add that plus one, right? So you add the one. And what do you get? 2964 plus 2300 minus one, you end up with 5263, which is the year in the common era of 1503. Anybody remember what year the Abarbanel said Mashiach was destined to come when he calculated based on the time and a half nevuah we had on the previous parak? I'll give you a guess. I'm trying to guess. 1503?
Right? No,
extra.
The same.
Yeah, it has to be, because the whole point here is that all the prophecies have to end up in the same place, says the Rishon. Okay. Of course, 1503 is only a handful of years after the expulsion from Spain in the year 1492. Rabanel doesn't live to see it, and 1503 has come and gone. So that brings us to the last of our calculations for today, which is the Malbim. And in these source pages, I've given you sort of the shorthand at the top. The Malbim writes the following. Ad ere boker apayim shloshmeh. The Malbim is most interesting for us, and we're gonna redo all of this next week. But the Malbim is most interesting for us. 2300. Hazman ad shiye erev dahainu ad achorban shiavo yedei haramim. This is until the time of the Churban brought about by the Romans. Ad shiye shenit boker, until there'll be another morning dawn. Tegula atida. This will be 2300 years, as Nitzdakodesh, then the temple will be victorious. Mine, im nachshav zman ze be'et ha-churban ha-rishon, if we calculate from the time of the first destruction of the first temple, which was in the year 33-38, so not from the Exodus and not from the exile, but from the destruction of the first temple, and I add 2300 to that number, I'll get 5638, which is the year 1878. However, again, the Malbim is writing after that time. It doesn't say that this time is going to start from the destruction of the first temple. So therefore, the Malbim says, let's do something a little different. We're talking about a conversation between the Malach and Daniel. The Malach says to Daniel, 2300. From when? From yesterday, from the day before, 2300 from the destruction of the first temple, 2300 from some victorious, right? 2300 from when? Says the Malach, 2300 from then. 2300 years from the day the conversation was taking place between Daniel and the Malach, which was Mishnat Gimel Belshazzar, which is 50 years after the destruction of the temple, because we're 20 years away from the end of the 70-year exile. So that means that we have to start from the year 3388, 50 years later. And if I take 3388 and I add 2300 to it, I end up in the year 5688, which is the year 1928. However, that time, times, and time and a half, that came to a different calculation, 1913. That came to 15 years earlier. So now I have two numbers, and the Malbim says they don't mix. They don't stim. Says the Malbim, it's because hefsek mamshelet hakeren zeira shebo diber lemala ad binyan mikdash v'akrevat tamid shebo diber kan yitarech 15 shana. It'll be 15 years between the time that the destruction of the Roman Empire and the allowance, the beginning of the redemption of Israel shall start until the temple is built. That'll be 15 years. How do I know it'll be 15 years? Because Chazal talk about a 7-year period of Malchut Beit David and another 7-year period of Gog Magog. And so you put it together, those are your 14 years, and we're now in year 15. And so the two numbers work. 1913 for the beginning of Cheshbon, Edan Adanin, time and a half. And 1928 for the 2300 years from the moment of the conversation with the Malach about the restoration of the Korban Tamid. Says the Malbim, that's the number. And there's your brief summary. If Sadigun says the Roman Empire and the destruction will be undone in the year by the year 988. Rashi says by the year 1397. Rabban says sometime by the middle of the 15th century. Abarbanel says by the year 1503. The Malbim says sometime between 1913 and 1928. And they've all gone. Now, I will say one thing about this year 1913. The Malbim's calculation. And I'm going to stop sharing here for a second. I will say one thing about the Malbim's calculation, because it's just fascinating to observe. And that is that, anybody know what year World War I began?
1914, wasn't it?
1914, Tisha B'Av 1914. So, and Rav Kook really writes that when the world, when the nations of the world are at war with each other, there's a kind of a mitorer koach haMashiach, right? The power of Mashiach comes alive. So World War I is fascinating because it also brought about the collapse of four empires, right? The Russian Empire, the Prussian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire. So the context of the Malbim's identification of 1913 and 1914 is somehow related to this. Just fascinating. In the context, again, we're going to go in a completely different direction next week, but it's just a fascinating little nuance to this whole discussion. And if we're already going there, you know what? I'm going to throw my hat, since everybody else threw their hat in the ring as far as calculations go, I'll throw another one, which is, what if we started the year of the 2300 from the year of the building of the Second Temple? What if the entire calculation of 2300 was from the building of the Second Temple? Anybody remember what year the Second Temple was built?
We don't know.
Well,
if you go according to Seder Olam.
Yeah, right. I'm working all these calculations. Know. Correct. All these calculations I'm working off of Seder Olam, because that's what the Rishonim did. Next week, we'll get much more academic. But for now, I'm working off Seder Olam, working off the numbers, just to throw out a little bit of material thought to consider. According to Seder Olam, the Second Temple is built in the year 70 years after the exile, in the year 3408. Correct? Okay. Yeah, I'm just throwing it out there. Add 2300 to it, and what do you get?
Fifty-seven oh eight
in the Hebrew calendar corresponds to what year in the English calendar?
Probably.
That you shouldn't have to worry. That you shouldn't have to think too hard about. 5708 is Tavshin Chet, Tashach, otherwise known as
1948
in English calendar, the year of the birth of the State of Israel. So I just throw that as a calculation. If you want to take Seder Olam and you want to take the number of 3408 and add to it the 2300 years, you may end up in the year 5708 or in something close thereof. I just, since everybody else threw a number into the hat, I might as well. However, we're going to take this all in a very different direction because, and I think my eye glanced a couple of comments in the chat, which is all based on one assumption. Everything we've said today is based on one assumption.
Seder Olam.
And that one assumption is, besides the years from Seder Olam, but it's based on the assumption that all the Rishonim take, save one. And that is that the Alpaim Shloshmiot refers to years.
Yes.
And based on that, they're trying to navigate all through this period of history. The only one to suggest that it's not years, but days, is the Ibn Ezra. And the Rishonim, particularly the Barbanel, rails against him for it. Virtually accuses him of being a heretic for it. Why and how that came about and what the controversy around that calculation was, Bezrat Hashem, that's our subject for next week. So we will adjourn here and we will pick up this story, Bezrat Hashem, next week. And I will pause for questions, but before I do, I will pause for station identification, and that is that next week we are you could put into the chat if you're located in Israel and therefore there's a conflict of schedule for next week, because next week in Israel it's this time slot falls under the Arab Yom HaTzmaut. So if you can just put into the chat if you're in Israel. If you're not in Israel, don't worry about it. I just need to get a sense of how many people are actually in Israel. And then we'll figure it out. But I'm assuming we're going to have a class on schedule next week. If you can't make it because it's in conflict with what's going on in Israel, that's okay. Israel takes precedence. This will be recorded, and you can always come back to it afterwards and watch the recording. So that is the that's the bottom line. Okay, questions?
Thank you very much, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure. Okay. Baruch to you. Thank you. And hopefully we'll see everybody. We're missing a few people today, but hopefully we'll see everybody by next week.
Thank you.
My pleasure.